At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome back to New Books in Religion. Thanks again for joining us. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. For each program, we choose an exciting new book on the study of religion, and we chat with the author. Today, I had the pleasure of speaking with Amanullah Dasandi about his great new book, The Crisis of Islamic Masculinities, which was published with Bloomsbury in 2014. What gets to count as Islam? In the current political climate, this question is being repeated in a variety of contexts. The tapestry, or for this conversation, I should say, the tartan, of various Islamic identities is revealed in an investigation of gender. In this great new book, Dasandi tackles the construction of Muslim manhood in several interpretive traditions. These forms of masculinity, both ideal and reviled, are taken across a wide spectrum of thought, from Islamist perspectives to those challenging patriarchy. Many of the discussions revolve around similar themes. Most importantly, family, marriage, sexuality, and veiling. Other constructions of masculinity challenge heteronormativity within Muslim identities. The Quran is central to many of the interpretations discussed in the book, but Dasandi demonstrates that here, too, we are not presented with a singular and clear ideal of masculinity. Quranic descriptions of male prophets, including Adam, Joseph, Muhammad, and Jesus, each complicate a simple narrative about Muslim manhood. In our conversation, we discuss hermeneutical strategies, feminist approaches to the Quran, notions of love and sexual boundaries, the Mughal poet Mirza Ghalib, gender fluidity, Sufism in South Asia, prophethood, and same-sex love. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Aman Dasandi. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion. Welcome again to New Books in Religion. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Amanullah Dasandi about his great new book, The Crisis of Islamic Masculinities, and is just about to come out in paperback, so all of you can pick up a nice, inexpensive copy. Hello, Aman. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I'm very glad to talk to you. This is a really great book. As someone who is in the field of Islamic studies, I know that there is a lot of talk about feminist approaches to Islam and ideas of gender related to women, but you're really at the forefront of this idea of masculinities. And I think this book does a really good job of kind of laying out some of the important questions we need to ask, how this might fit into these larger conversations about gender. And I really think anyone interested in gender studies and religious studies will really benefit from it. So thank you for writing this, and thank you for talking to me.
Thank you.
Before we get into the content, as is tradition with the channel, I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about how you got interested in the study of religion, how you got interested in Islamic studies, perhaps people or events along the way that have been influential in how you came to where you are now.
So I'm trying to think where I should start this journey. I was born and raised in Glasgow in Scotland, where religion is a compulsory subject through an act of law in Scottish primary and secondary schools. And I was always intrigued by religion. At a point in my life, I went to a Protestant school, and then I went to a Catholic school. And I learned all sorts of different dimensions to religion And in high school, I was very intrigued by religion. And what really intrigued me was thinking critically about religion and asking the difficult questions, which I did at school, at high school, and also at home. So I was always seen as a bit of a troublemaker when it came to asking critical questions about religion, but I kept asking them. And so after high school, I went to France, where I studied Arabic for 1 year. And I came back to Glasgow, and I wanted to become a primary school teacher. But then I had an influential mentor who is a Methodist minister, and he said to me, well, why don't you go and study religion? So I went to study religious studies at the University of Stirling, which is at the very heart of Scotland. And of course, no jokes about Braveheart here. and I did a degree in religious studies with the diploma in education. And so I qualified as a secondary school teacher of religious education. Throughout my 4.5 years at Stirling, I studied quite a diverse range of religious studies topics, from Buddhism to political Islam to women in African traditional religions to possession theory in the Sudan. And I qualified as a secondary school teacher. And at that time, I was probably, if not the only Muslim teaching religious education in secondary schools in Scotland. And I enjoyed it very much. I helped to shape much of the curriculum and that's still in place in Scottish secondary schools. I consulted to the Scottish government. I also took part in a lot of in-service for secondary school teachers. And I enjoyed the real critical inquiry. And I think I felt very much at home doing that in a purely academic setting where I was not expected to defend Islam or apologize for Islam, and it really helped me to think about where I wanted to go in terms of the study of Islam. And so after teaching for a while, I decided that I was going to continue with my studies, and I decided to do a master in literature in Islamic and Jerusalem studies at the University of Abertay in Dundee, which was really quite eye-opening for me because it was more advanced postgraduate study. I was always intrigued by Jerusalem and thinking about Jerusalem as an inclusive city and the connection between the three faiths. But very quickly I realized that it was a minefield, that I was expected to say particular things being Muslim. And I was really, again, I was intrigued only to pursue at the very core an academic critical study into whatever I was looking at. So after my master's, I decided that I was going to teach for a little while. I was also... I became a lead researcher for quite a substantial grant which came from the Ford Foundation, and I led a study on philanthropy for social justice amongst British Muslims at a time where it was the aftermath of 9/11. And so I learned a lot at that time of doing this balancing act of trying to be honest and critical to what I was looking at, but still being, you know, aware of the sense and sensibilities that Muslims have. After the study, I finished that project, which was actually headed from Emory with Abdullahi and Naeem. And after finishing that British Muslim project, I conducted my PhD research at the University of Glasgow, my city. I was very excited about doing this in my home city. And I did my PhD in the study of Islamic masculinities. So that was really, really my journey. And in between that, I did continue to help and teach in secondary schools religious education. After I finished my PhD, I went on the job market, and the job that I got was at Ithaca College in upstate New York, and I moved from Scotland to Ithaca, and I taught there for 1 year, and then from there I moved to the University of Miami in a visiting position, and then I'm on the tenure track at the moment, but I have now accepted a position back in Europe, in Ireland, in Ireland's first secular department of religions, as senior lecturer in contemporary Islam. So that's really my journey. Also, in between that, I studied Arabic in Syria and also in Jordan.
Well, congratulations, Aman. That's really great news about your new position.
Thank you.
Now, the whole field of Islamic masculinities, this is something that you are very much at the forefront of. But I can't imagine that you saw yourself in that way when this project was emerging. So could you talk a little bit about how this began to be thought about as a book? And perhaps can you talk a little bit about perhaps any ways you had to rethink your dissertation into making it a book?
So I think I began thinking very closely on issues of masculinity when I was taking courses at the undergraduate level on women in traditional African religions. I was studying with Mary Keller, who is at the University of Wyoming at the moment. And I also worked closely during my master's with Anne-Sophie Rold, who I think, correct me on this, someone will, I'm sure. I think her book was quite a pioneering book when it came to women in the Western experience. And I remember she gave a public lecture in Dundee, on women in the West or in Europe. And I sat there thinking to myself that, you know, why is it that we continually talk about women where actually we should be talking about men? And I stood up and said this, and it probably all came out really jumbled up, but she looked at me and she said, "You should, you know, pursue this." and I looked at her and I thought, you know what? I think that's what I'm going to do. And from there, I remember the early days of my PhD, and I really had this idea of working on masculinity, but I had no real kind of, you know, core thesis point. And I was chatting and talking to a lot of people. I remember at one of the AARs, I met Keisha Ali. Somebody introduced me to her and said, you know, oh, Aman's working on a PhD on Islam and masculinity. And I thought to myself, oh, no, she's going to ask me, what exactly are you looking at? And I'm so early on doing all this reading, and I really don't know what to say to somebody who I look up to. And I remember walking with Keisha and saying to her, yeah, and just kind of like early days. And she must have thought, you're right, okay, he has no idea what he's doing. And it's really quite interesting that she kind of, you know, has been a real mentor at some level in helping me think closely about what I wanted to do. But, you know, my work is really an exploration. It's a book that's an open book. I really want people, academics, non-academics, anyone to, you know, open up the deliberation and the discussion on what it means to be Muslim and male, and what are the implications of that. And that is really at the very core of what I'm trying to do. I'm not a theologian. I work purely and primarily as a scholar of religion, a critical scholar of religion. I am not invested at all at a scholarly level to stating what the best form of Islamic masculinity is. I feel that that's a project that other people are undertaking and should undertake, and that's not my duty and role as an academic. So I'm really interested and intrigued by the discussion on Islamic masculinities.
Yeah, and you do a great job. You really open up the conversation, especially for people that might not be thinking about this already. And so you do this through a number of case studies, I guess we can call them, which we'll get into in a moment. But I was hoping you could first talk a little bit about this idea of masculinity being constructed. Basically, give us a gender studies 101 for the uninitiated. And also, much of what the book does is look at how masculinity is constructed, and at the same time, we simultaneously construct femininity. So can you talk a little bit about this idea of gender being constructed, and then how you perhaps took that to the study of Islam?
Well, how is gender constructed? I mean, how is your masculinity constructed? How is my masculinity constructed? It is constructed through a series of interactions with the other. And I know that sounds very technical and people are very confused, because the use of the term other is used in many different ways when it comes to, I don't know, people think about Islam and other faiths but at a purely level of subjectivity and being, we are what we are based on a series of interactions that we have with everything that surrounds us. So from an early age, it's about the interaction that we've had with our parents or those who have looked after you, your siblings, your teachers, you know, interaction with other males and other females. So I think that by and large would be at the very crux of how gender is socially constructed. Now, the interesting addition when it comes to Islamic masculinities is that you have this additional construction of God. And when you include God in the debate, it has the potential to create all sorts of other power dynamics.
And so you take this and basically apply it to various studies. And in the first two chapters, at least I read them as kind of almost diametrically opposed. So in the first chapter, you look at this figure, Maududi. So could you give us a little bit of background of who Maududi is, what perhaps he's all about, what kind of things shape his intellectual context? Give us an idea of who this is.
So, as we know, Maududi was one of the, so to speak, founding fathers of Pakistan. Was also a religious leader, and he constructed a very particular form of masculinity through the way in which he understood other men and women, how he understood God in a very particular way, how he felt charged to uphold a very particular form of Islam, also which came about through the end of the British Raj and the emergence of Pakistan as an Islamic state. So I argue in my book that masculinity, Islamic masculinity, is constructed by using particular foils. And the foil that Maududi uses is quite centrally focused on the West and the way in which he sees the West. And he feels that Islam needs to be upheld in a particular way. Now, Maududi had very particular ideas of what it meant to be a Muslim woman and what it meant to be a Muslim man. He wrote a book titled Parda, The Veil, in which he talks about the role of Muslim women, why Muslim women are different from women in the West. And he does this quite fantastically through using all sorts of different ideas and hermeneutics that emerge from the Quran. But he really upheld the central notion of family, a very heterosexual family, and very rigid and strong gender roles on women as the homemaker and men as the breadwinner. Now, at a political level, this was quite superb because his aim, by and large, I think what he was also continuing in the same line as Islamic legal scholars that we see in the medieval period, was that he wanted to create stability, social stability, and in society, and deviant masculinity and femininity disrupt social stability. So he was very clear and very powerful in trying to uphold a very particular form that he felt was going to rule the day, and in fact it did. So that was the charge that Maududi placed. I think we still see the effects of that, because what Maududi was saying, the very rigid forms of masculinity and femininity, also were being said by the likes of anybody else who wanted to and who wants to uphold something essentially Islamic at the state level and at the social level, because that rigidity gave some power to that political formula.
Now, you follow that up almost at the opposite end of the spectrum, and you focus on what you call feminist Muslim thinkers. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about what that means to be a feminist Muslim. But in your discussion, they're talking about many of the same ideals or themes, marriage, family, veiling, that Maududi was using to construct his ideas about masculinity and femininity. Where does this feminist perspective kind of challenge his ideals?
Well, the Maududi-esque model of masculinity and femininity has been critiqued by Muslim feminists, some Muslim women who don't want to be categorized as feminists, and to look more closely at that debate, you would have to read the work of Asma Berlas, who does not like to be categorized as a feminist because of the connotations involved in our general ideas of feminism, which is constructed primarily through a Western model, and so that is challenged. But the Muslim feminists that I explore in the second chapter are critiquing what Maududi is saying. They are doing that through two means. One is through their own lives, and secondly by going back to the core text, which is the Quran, and they are looking at ways in which they can challenge what Maududi was saying, because the effects of what Maududi was saying and upheld has the potential to create a lot of injustice, and a lot of injustice particularly against Muslim women. So Muslim women are trying to find a way of challenging the kind of hierarchy, I think, to an extent, what Maududi had put forward through looking, they look through hermeneutics without hegemony, What is significant is that they still uphold the idea of family. And so family is I think particularly key. Also because most of the predominant voices that we hear from Muslim feminists are heterosexual. So they still want to honor the position and the place of family.
Now, could you tell us some of the hermeneutical strategies that they're using in their reading of the Quran? How do they think about it?
Well, I mean, at the very core of this is that the Quran is a text, and text can be read in multiple forms. And so part of my project is to say, look, if we look at the Quran and we accept that, you know, the billion or so Muslims globally accept this text as divine, then every individual has a right to read that text in whatever way they want. And there can be multiple ways of reading the text. So, for example, on passages of the Quran, which at a literal level can be seen as difficult. For example, the passage of the Quran which has been presented as the passage that allows men to beat their wives. How many different ways can you read that passage, that part of the Quran? How do you put that into effect? What does that do to the way in which Maududi looks to the Quran? What does that do to the way in which Muslim feminists look towards the Quran? So I'm really interested in exploring the multi-form ways in which the Quran can be read, and what are the outgrowths from that form of understanding.
Now, one of the other critiques that many of these authors that you're looking at put forth is that when they return to the Quran, they find that the rigid constructions of gender that have been out there are not necessarily read in the Quran itself, which leads them to argue that it's within the interpretive tradition, especially how it's applied through Islamic law. So can you talk a little bit about how gender constructions get constructed through Islamic law?
My theory on this is that the Quran is quite a fantastic text because it is not a legal text. And scripture, by its very nature, is full of stories. And stories can be read in a variety of different ways. And that's why I think religions and scripture continues to play a very significant role in the life of a believer and the life of society at large. So the text is a text. It can be interpreted in a variety of ways. The way I present the Quran is I say that the Quran is perfectly ambiguous. I think that the Quran as a text is superbly dysfunctional. It allows, because it is a thinking text, the Quran has to breathe the life and the soul and the belief and faith into an individual, not through rote reading and just repetition, but through thinking and through pondering. And that is key to the way in which the text is read at the time of its revelation, at the time that it's understood. Now, I think that the Islamic, this was mind-boggling to Islamic jurists who thought, well, this is opening up a huge can of worms. What do we do with a text that goes from one place to another? It contradicts itself. And so the Islamic legal system tried to clarify that ambiguous nature. But I think, at a fantastic level, that trying to resolve or to shape in an orderly way is not godly. So the text, the messiness of the text, the dysfunctionality of the text is something that I think is intrinsic and key to what the Quran is trying to do for people who think, for people who reflect on that text. And the Islamic jurists try to create order in exactly the same way that Maududi was trying to create order and trying to imagine what an Islamic state was. Now, the easy way out is, nowadays we love to throw out discussions and labels, oh, this is progressive and this is liberal and this is conservative. Well, you know, if you want to be faithful and you want to be true to the nature of the text, you have to be able to accept that those jurists who felt that they were being faithful to the text, they have a right to say what they have to say, and so does Maududi, and so do the Muslim feminists. So that is, you know, in the early parts of my book, what I'm trying to open up the debate about is that look how fantastic this idea about God and Islam and all of this is when it comes to really viewing the multiple ways in which Muslim men and women have understood their religion and understood their connection to God. So this idea, I think inadvertently, I challenge this idea that people think that Islam needs a reformation, because then if you have a cardboard cutout understanding of Islam in the same way that you have of men and women, you will have a cardboard cutout understanding of what it means to have faith. So reformation, reform is happening and has happened from the very beginning through individual experiences about the relationship that men and women have with God. No two Muslims are alike in exactly the same way that there are no two Jews and two Christians who are alike, men or women. And I am interested and intrigued to open up the gates to say how is this happening, and really beginning to appreciate that whether you agree to diversity or not, you have to accept that there are individual beings who challenge so many things that we all stand for.
Yeah, and this comes out in your own reading of the Quran. I guess inspired by these figures and their kind of reading of the text, you then look to see, well, how is masculinity constructed in the Quran itself? And you present in the chapter multiple ways. You find that there isn't a single narrative about masculinity.
Yes.
So could you walk us through some of these figures? You look at Adam, you look at Joseph, you look at Muhammad, you look at Jesus. Each of these figures present us a different ideal of what masculinity is.
Yeah.
So could you give us maybe perhaps a little background too? Some listeners might not be familiar with the way people like Adam or people like Jesus are presented in the Quran, and what do these each of these figures tell us about masculinity?
So the oft repeated answer to many questions that you would pose to a Muslim: why do you not drink alcohol? Why do Muslims wear the hijab? And you know, many of them will turn to you and say, in the Quran. So if the Quran is an essential and pivotal point in the lives of Muslims, then you would expect, you know, a simple answer. But as I've already said to you, I don't think the Quran is trying to give simple answers. So you can pose the question to the Quran: What is the ideal Islamic masculinity? And I think that the Quran supports the work of sociologists and anthropologists who are telling us that there's no one way to be masculine, to be male. And I think that the Quran upholds that. And we see that through the life and times of these prophets. So we see within Adam, what was the role of Adam? What was the relationship that he had with Eve? Were they even married? Do they uphold this idea of marriage? Does the Quran uphold an idea of a very secure and locked understanding of what it means to have a family? I don't think so, because the Quran is full of dysfunctional families. You have Adam and Eve who, you know, their primary and central command from God was not to get married and have children and, you know, give them a good education and all of that. It was submit to this God. And that submission was the central and crucial point of what they had to do. All else was secondary. Now, as I said to you, there are many ways in which you can read stories. So if you are, and we have to accept that we live in still times which are deeply patriarchal, deeply male-centered, deeply heteronormative. So somebody who wants to uphold all of that, and remember, most men, if not all men, don't want to rock the status quo. They want to be the center of the universe to a certain level. So they will read from the story of Adam and Eve, they will read out of that how to support and sustain patriarchy. And I think this is very well articulated in the work of Asma Barlas when she unreads patriarchy in the Quran. Then we look at Joseph. We don't know if Joseph ever got married, but we do know that there was some sexual shenanigans going on with his adopted family. What does that tell us? What does that tell us about what it meant to, when we look at particularly at the at what masculinity meant in the life of Joseph? When we look at the Prophet Muhammad, we see, the Prophet's life is extremely colorful. And he receives a lot of critique on this, on the way in which we look at the Prophet's life. He married multiple wives. The critical point of how young one of his wives was. All of this presents us with a lot of very challenging ideas of what it means to be Muslim and male. But again, even with the life of the Prophet Muhammad, we know that the central objective was submission and belief in that one God. Everything else was secondary. Then we move to the life of Jesus. Jesus is totally challenging the biological affairs. Who was Jesus' father? What role did his mother play? Did Jesus get married? Well, if these are central figures of the in the Quranic world, then what is God playing at in trying to challenge the readers of this text? And the challenge is rooted to the centrality of God. And the centrality of the way in which human beings, not just human beings, but the creation of angels, everything that God creates, submits to God. So in a sense, the central and key point is not often about gender or sexuality. It is about what that being does. So this leads us on to questions and further critique about, where are the female prophets in the Quran? Well, if you want to read male-only prophets from the Quran, you can do that. But we're also challenged, jurists and Islamic scholars in the past have told us, maybe Mary was a prophet. She received a communication with God. She was trying to uphold this idea of God's centrality and God's existence. Why is Eve not a prophet? So this leads to all sorts of other discussions and debates. And male-only prophets, understood by men, does something to construct a particular form of Islamic masculinity. All of this is I think, going to be very crucial for us to look closely at in the difficult times that we are facing today.
Now, the second half of the book, you also challenge kind of the heteronormativity of Islamic masculinities. One chapter you focus on this very, very interesting figure, Mirza Ghalib. Mm-hmm. Paint a picture for us. Who is this figure? He had a very fascinating life, very interesting thoughts. Can you give us some background on who this person is?
So Mirza Ghalib presents us with a very hedonistic challenge in the face of Maududi-esque forms of Islamic masculinity and femininity. Mirza Ghalib was a Mughal poet, a drunk. He loved his alcohol and he loved his women. He was ostracized from mainstream Islamic society. He was very public about his challenge to those particular norms and ways. He would be known to wander the streets with crates of booze, and he would be very open about that. He it's also said that most of his poetry was written whilst he was completely pished and drunk. So he but what I find very interesting about Mirza Ghalib is that he was deeply invested in the God question. His poetry is infused with the same forms of submission that we see in the way in which Maududi presents us Islamic masculinity, and is exactly the same way that you see within the Quranic narrative. And so Mirza Ghalib presents us with a form of Islamic masculinity which is very challenging to a very mainstream, very rigid approach to what it means to be Islamic and what it means to be Muslim. He also constructed his masculinity through interactions with others, particularly those who felt that he was not upholding a good form of Islam, and he challenged that and dismissed it, because he continually reminded us that spirituality and faith is a personal matter, and it cannot be typified and replicated. And I think that was that is very Quranic and Islamic. And so I wanted to present a polar opposite to Maududi with exactly the same label of saying that they are Islamic, and if they're not Islamic, why are they not Islamic?
Yeah, I really enjoyed this chapter, and I think Mirza Ghalib is one of your favorite people. So I want to push you a little bit farther here. One of the things that you kind of highlight in the chapter is, unlike people like Maududi, or even like some of these female Muslim thinkers that you're talking about, his masculinity was not based in relations of marriage. You talk about his marriage being, not very successful. It's not based on family. You talk about that he doesn't have any children that live on. And so his much of his ideas about masculinity were constructed in relation to other men, which I think is unique. And you talk about how it's constructed in relation to his military family and ideas he has about his own fitting into that context. And then also in relation to other poets. And this seemed like a wonderful scene. And I'm wondering if you could tell us about how these kind of interactions, especially in relation to his poetry, which he is so well known for, how was this kind of playing out in his life?
Well, I'm not entirely convinced that his marriage was not successful. I think he was deeply in love with his wife, but he loved a lot of women, and this idea of very rigid gender roles is challenged by Mirza Ghalib, because Mirza Ghalib gives us a picture of a man who was very committed, I think, in his own way, to what it meant to be Muslim. He was committed to his wife. His wife, ostracized him at times from his own house because she would separate the dishware, because she felt that, oh, you're a drunk, and I'm fasting and I'm praying. And it was very interesting but I think there was a playful element to it. She loved him dearly throughout all of this, and he would frequent courtesans. He also, made statements alluding to same sex and not dismissing it, but to an extent, accepting it, and it gives you an idea of what was actually happening in society. So to be Muslim and male, but in Mughal society was rather fluid. Was, you know, you could have a wife at home, you could frequent a courtesan, and maybe you could have a boy at the side. This, in their view, was very Islamic and very faithful. But again, I think Mirza Ghalib's challenge is to the very core idea of family. That the family, I think it was Amina Wadud who said this, the family becomes the point, can become the unit that upholds patriarchy and harm, or it has the potential to do something better than that. And in no way am I saying that let's do away with family, but what I'm saying is that I think within the umbrella of saying what is Islamic, there is room for maneuver, there is scope for opening up that debate that we see when we bring into the discussion the likes of those who have been dismissed from the table, such as Mirza Ghalib. And Mirza Ghalib's world was a very interesting world. He lived a very full life. His poetry is, I would say, deeply theological. And he is very much invested in trying to present what he understands as submission to God.
You wrap up the book with another kind of subversive sphere, I guess we can call it, focused on different aspects of Sufism, both kind of in thought and then in practice. And one of the themes you touch upon is how ideas of masculinity and femininity are kind of play out in Sufi thought, and then how that gets applied within lived practice. So issues of celibacy, what's the role of sex or marriage, what are perceptions of women. And you touch upon this long history, but can you kind of give us some of the highlights of how masculinity and femininity are thought about more broadly from a Sufi perspective?
Well, you know, I've always been intrigued by Sufism, especially given our current state of affairs, where sometimes we fall trapped to this idea that Sufism can become the salvation to everything that is ugly within Islam. I think a more critical study of Sufism kind of unveils that there is an element of same old there in terms of the way in which gender and sexuality is constructed, because it had to interact with society. And society at large was still very rigid and still wanted some particular form. So I think at the very core, the philosophy and the idea of Sufism is, again, fantastic, absolutely fabulous, you know, of the individual relationship with God and, you know, wrap yourself in wool and wander around like a dervish or whirl around. Great. But the crux and the core of the matter is that not everybody can live a life like that. And so you still have, you know, elements within Sufism that were trying to locate itself in a society which was, you know, by and large, heteronormative and very particular about what gender was. So this idea of celibacy, you know, celibate Sufis or Sufis who got married and were still wanting to uphold this idea of family. And it was actually my PhD supervisor, Lloyd Ridgen, who gave me a lot to think about. I mean, you know, I think we underestimate at times how much PhD supervisors push you to think. And my PhD supervisor certainly made me think rather than help, you know, take me to a particular conclusion. And that I feel quite blessed by that. And one road he took me on was looking at the Sufi calendars. And the calendars are fantastic. They're they're great. They really challenge society. They are gender bending. They are men dressed up as women. Some of them will categorize themselves as lovers of everybody, which is a nice way of saying that they're homosexual in a society that's not really going to accept them under that label. Or some, or a lot of them would say we're heterosexual. They wear women's clothing. They're high as a kite. They're smoking all sorts of intoxicants and drinking all sorts of things, dancing at the shrines of Sufi saints, and still saying the challenge to society is they're saying we are still submitted to God. You know, take that, and it's great because again, it's a challenge to any Muslim man or woman who wants to create an ideal to say, look, this is my Islam and my Islam doesn't have to be your Islam. So this is why I think the chapter on Sufism had to be there to continue the discussion on what it means to be male. And within that chapter, I also open up the discussion on the connection between Islamic masculinity, femininity, and sexuality, because I've taken you on this journey of my book, and if at the very core of what I'm saying is that it's an individual act, an individual participation and presentation of how an individual lives their life as male or female, then really the question of sexuality just drops at the wayside, because the core idea is about how men and women submit to God and how that makes them do good, how they uphold goodness and what they do in society. And by looking at that very core idea, it's a huge challenge to those who want to uphold particular forms of sexuality, because as we've seen from the Quranic model, we don't know if some of these prophets even had sex, who they had sex with, whether they had children. So that opens up a much needed discussion, which I think is not so interesting for me as an academic when it comes to, you know, we should be open to ideas of sexuality and, you know, we have to look at LGBTQ issues and this is just a yes or a no. I'm interested in trying to develop an idea that interacts with these questions from a masculinity and a femininity point of view. And I think we can open up and have a very fruitful discussion if you want. So the core point, another core point that I present is that if you place Maududi and Mirza Ghalib and these Qalandari Mullahs all together, it's very difficult to say one is better than the other, because they're all Islamic. They're all saying that they're Islamic. They're all saying that they're Muslim, and they're all submitted to God. That, I think, is sorely needed today to appreciate amongst Muslims, to have the intra discussion and then to have the inter discussion. And I think, I hope this will affect the way in which we live at a very difficult moment in history.
Mm. Yeah, that's, I think, a great way to wrap up the discussion of the book. If I can just push you a little further, though, since this, you really, I think you even said yourself, you were trying to open the door on this idea of Islamic masculinities. Where do you think people can go within this field? What kind of things do you think need to be done going forward?
Well, you know, it's...
What's your wish list? What would you like to see done?
The first part of what I want to see done is I want people to at least acknowledge the debate. There's a secondary phase to this, which is in the hands of those who want to take up the activist challenge. And this is one of the reasons why I think many activists or those scholars of Islam who want to be scholar activists are maybe a little upset with me. They say, well, can you tell us, you've done all this great work, but can you please tell us that Maududi's model is a bad model? Well, I'm sorry, I can't do that because as a scholar, as an academic, that's not my role. So my, you know, my wish list would be for us to at least acknowledge that you can have this great tapestry, you know, or tartan. I just thought I'd throw that one in there. Of all these wonderful forms of masculinity and femininity, and accept them. Now, the problem is that accepting diversity at this core level will be very confusing for people because, you know, I'm pushing academics and Muslims and non-Muslims to accept such diversity that I think will be very difficult for people who want to create an order. Now, that order, in the way that Maududi wanted to create a rigid order, or an order which, you know, far lefties or progressives want to create their political way of order, I don't think I help any of them. But I think this is what frustrates them. But as an academic, I feel that my role is to open up the discussion, and God knows where this will lead. But it's exciting because, you know, just the other day I was invited to Emory University, where I was asked to speak about the intersection of my book with public health and how, you know, public health officials and from the West can go into Islamic societies and how they negotiate their presence. And I sat there and I said, look, maybe we'll not have all the answers to what you're thinking, but I'm just amazed that I have been able to get you to think about, you know, how this type of discussion can really empower us. And I hope at the very core, it also builds a bridge. I'm a bridge builder at the very core. And I think, you know, one of the biggest challenges that we face today is the cementing, the continual cementing of an Islam versus West. And I think that if we begin to appreciate this complexity of Islamic masculinities and femininities and really beginning to appreciate that there's not that much different between all of these varieties of men and women who are Muslim and those who are not, I think that can also help to bridge that divide. Mm.
Well, this book is certainly a great start for that. Imam, before I let you go, can you tell us what kind of things you have going on now? What kind of projects you're working on?
I have begun researching for my second book, which will look at Islam in Pakistan. And I'm going to leave that rather general and vague because I'm at the very early stages of trying to make sense of that. And I'm really interested in looking particularly at the media and the arts and the entertainment world in Pakistan and really following the trajectory of the development of that in Pakistan in contemporary times. So I'm hoping to get to Pakistan at some point to conduct some further research on that. I'm still invested in looking at British Muslim studies. I'm hoping to edit a book which brings together scholarship on the history and the contemporary debates surrounding Islam in Britain. I'm also hoping to edit another book that will be a book on Islamic masculinities between theology and law. So if anybody is interested and wants to participate in this discussion on British Muslim studies or Islamic masculinities, please get in touch with me. I think we're at a very interesting period of time where Islamic studies is thriving, and we need to help in securing and cementing the way for more critical scholarship of Islam and opening up the debate and opening up the critique. And I think that will be very helpful to us and to the academy at large.
Great. Well, good luck, Aman. And thank you very much for making the time to talk about your wonderful book today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion. That was my conversation with Aman Aladdissandi,
about his great new book, The Crisis of Islamic Masculinities, published with Bloomsbury Press in 2014.